Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. On July 11th, 1960, Harper Lee's iconic novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, was originally published. To celebrate the 62nd anniversary of this literary event, this week, screenwriter Aaron Sorkin chats with Professor Ivy Wilson about how he adapted Lee's novel for the stage. This conversation was recorded for the American Writers Festival on May 15, 2022, which featured more than 75 leading writers from across the country. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hello, and welcome everyone to this online program of the American Writers Festival, the inaugural literary event celebrating the American Writers Museum's 5th anniversary. I'm Kerry Cranston. I'm the president of the American Writers Museum. The great works of literature included in the American Writers Museum's permanent exhibits are there because of their enduring relevance to our lives today. There's hardly a seventh grader in the country who doesn't need to read To Kill a Mockingbird. So to find something new in Harper Lee's enduring book takes a writer willing to interrogate if virtues are simultaneously vices and what the limits are of walking in someone else's shoes. Academy, Emmy, and Golden Globe winning writer and director Aaron Sorkin's reimagining of the Mockingbird story for Broadway comes to Chicago this week, and he's here to discuss it with AWM board member Dr. Ivy Wilson, Northwestern University professor of English and director of the Black Arts Consortium. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being with us.
But good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ivy Wilson. I am honored to be here this afternoon with Aaron Sorkin, who almost needs no introduction. Amongst his many, many important works in American culture over the last many decades, the fabulous show, The West Wing, an early important film called A Few Good Men. More recently, a critique, a re-envisioning of Chicago at a really crucial moment in American history with the Chicago 7. It's my very deep pleasure to welcome Aaron Sorkin to the Writers Festival here in Chicago for 2022. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
Aaron, I thought since this is for our conversation today, it's really has a wide and capacious audience, but falls underneath the umbrella of a Writers Festival. Mm-hmm. And you're a film director, you're a screenwriter, you're a playwright, you've also acted yourself. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your process as a writer, and specifically what it meant to engage one of the most important novels in American literature of the 20th century and adapt it to the stage. So can you just tell us a bit about moving it from the novel and into a script?
Sure. Right around 2015, 2016, I think it was, a producer I'd worked with a number of times, he's a great Broadway producer, called me and said, I have some exciting news. After several years of trying, I've secured the Broadway stage rights for To Kill a Mockingbird, and I want you to write the play. And immediately, I thought this was a suicide mission. This is a book that holds a sacred place on America's bookshelf, in fact, the world's bookshelf. We all read it in seventh, eighth, ninth grade. What could I possibly do that would make it, that wouldn't make it less than it was? Why would I want to put on a PowerPoint presentation on the difference between Harper Lee's writing ability and my own? Be like getting into a competition with Tom Brady where points were awarded based on passing efficiency and handsomeness. But I said yes right away because of the opportunity to be back in the theater, back in a rehearsal room, pacing at the back of the orchestra, and the opportunity to work with this material. So I said yes right away. And maybe 9 or 12 months later, I delivered a first draft, and that first draft was terrible. It was, what I had done was, I kind of tried to swaddle the book in bubble wrap and gently transfer it to a stage without doing much damage to it. I just took what I thought were the most important things and stood them up, and there it was. And I think the best thing you could say about it was that it was harmless, which is probably the worst thing you can say about a play, particularly the story of To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I went back, I threw that first draft out, and I started again. This time, facing some hard truths about To Kill a Mockingbird, the novel. One of the more important ones was this. Atticus in the novel, and in the movie as well, doesn't change. He's the same person at the end of the story as he is at the beginning. And a protagonist has to change, and a protagonist has to have a flaw. I thought, why then was Harper Lee able to get away with having an Atticus who didn't change? Why was Horton Foote, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay, why was he able to get away with having an Atticus who's the same at the end as he is at the beginning? And the answer is, in the book and in the movie, Atticus isn't the protagonist, Scout is. She changes by losing some of her innocence. Her flaw is that she's young. Well, I wanted to keep the kids, Scout, her brother Jem, their friend Dill, I wanted to keep them as protagonists, but I wanted the central protagonist to be Atticus, which meant he was going to have a flaw and he was going to have to change. So what was that going to be? Was he going to go from being a good father to a bad father to a good father, a bad lawyer to a good lawyer, a racist to someone who believes in equality, justice, and inclusion? And No. And then I realized just reading the book again, and I have to tell you, just going back and revisiting a book that I hadn't read since eighth grade, I'd seen the movie a whole bunch of times, but hadn't read the book since eighth grade. There were a number of things in the book that I found troubling about Atticus, and primarily it was that he is constantly excusing racism. Bob Yule, who is in the book and in the movie, he's just a horrible racist. In the play, I made him what he is, which is a Klan member. About Bob Yule, he says, well, you got to understand, he just lost his WPA job. That makes a man feel small. So, you know, let's walk in Bob Yule's shoes for a mile and see how we feel. The next door neighbor, Mrs. DeBose, is a terrible racist. Well, you got to understand, she just stopped taking her medication, and that changes a person. About the whole town, you got to understand, this is the Deep South. Things move slower here in the Deep South. Just give Makem time. And his belief that there's goodness that can be found in everyone, and to really know someone, you've got to crawl around in their skin. And it was right around that moment, sort of in my thinking of that Atticus already had a flaw. It's just that it was taught to us as a virtue, this idea that there's goodness in everyone and you have to crawl around in everyone's skin. It was right around that time that Donald Trump got up and said there were very fine people on both sides. And I thought, okay, here it is. Not for a moment do I think that Atticus and Donald Trump are the same person. There's plenty of daylight between the two of them. Just not enough daylight for my taste, for a hero. So Atticus was going to go from, just as the country in the last 4, 5, 6 years has kind of gone through an awakening of, I thought that a lot of this stuff was 60 years ago, was deep in our past. And isolated to Mississippi, this awakening of who our friends and neighbors were, that they weren't quite who I thought they were. This was going to be the journey that Atticus was going to take, this awakening. I made a couple of other decisions. One was that I can't do a Harper Lee impersonation. I can only write like myself, and I can't pretend I'm writing this play in 1959. I have to write it today, and that helped me get all that helped me get pointed in the right direction.
Aaron, I'm listening to some of your phrases here, and I don't know if in other conversations you've been called idiosyncratic or a rule breaker or a bull, but like, can you say a little bit more about what would it mean for you as a writer to take a character, a much revered character, and to render them much more than one-dimensional, to render them complex and maybe even that complexity have some contradictions. So you said, for example, his you went to churn his virtue, or you recognize in his virtue a kind of flaw, when in fact the virtue had stood not simply as a model, but as an exemplar for decade after decade after decade for some kind of father figure or some kind of moral compass for the nation. How did you see in that particular version of Atticus, the novel version, maybe even the film version, but the mm-hmm. novel version for sure, that kind of virtue had its limitations and perhaps even was a flaw?
It was where it really hit me. It was kind of a bug flying around me. And when it landed on me and stung me was a moment in the novel when Jem gets angry at an extended family member, at an aunt of his, because she's used the N-word. Jem, a young kid, kind of scolds her for it. And Atticus gets very angry at Jem and makes Jem apologize for doing that. I just thought, okay, I buy it as being real, but it's not virtuous. And it was meant to be. It was taught to us as you see. Atticus is saying, I don't even know what the hell Atticus was saying there, but it also, listen, I want to answer your question before I get to like another answer of a question. You asked me how I feel. Listen, I was plenty nervous about fooling around at all with Atticus, to say nothing of changing him the way he was ultimately changed. I did not think I was going to get hoisted on anyone's shoulders. I thought I was really going to take it in the teeth for this. And it happily, it turned out just the opposite.
Yeah, sure. And not simply because of the awards and the acclaim, but you really did find a way to, I think one word that maybe I should have foregone here earlier is that you really are in conversation with Harper Lee. This isn't a critique or a kind of deviation, but you render her character in a different kind of complexity. And that's what I'm getting at here. With the
yes, I'm glad you said that. The first line of the play, and Scout, Jem, and Dill, who are played by young adults, which works just fine. On the stage. They're not played by children. And they speak directly to the audience. It's as if the play takes place tonight in this theater. And Scout is trying to puzzle through the first line of the play. Scout says to the audience, something didn't make sense. And right away, we're meant to understand. And by the way, when the curtain goes up, it goes up not on the front porch of the Finch House. It doesn't go up on a courtroom. It goes up on kind of an old broken down warehouse, sort of like where Childish Gambino's This Is America video takes place. The windows are broken. Everything is faded. And it's meant to evoke, we are revisiting something that we're all familiar with, and questioning some of the things that we were taught and that we believed about this story. So, yes, it's very much meant to be
in conversation
with Harper Lee is a good way of putting it. I don't want to get to this before you do, but another big deal to me was Calpurnia and Tom Robinson, those two characters.
I'm more than happy. I mean, you're the director. You're the film director. So I'm happy to lead here. So,
Calpurnia, the housekeeper, Tom Robinson, the defendant, are the only two significant Black characters in the story. And going back and rereading the story, it was just strange to me that in a story about racial tension in the Jim Crow South, the only two significant black characters don't really have much to say about it. Calpurnia is most concerned with whether Scout's going to wear a camisole or blue jeans to her first day of school. And Tom Robinson just gets to plead for his life. That's all. And so I thought, again, 1959, 1960, it probably went unnoticed, at least by white people, that African Americans were being used as atmosphere in this play that was about, in the story that was about white people. But not only would it not go unnoticed in 2018 when the play opened, but it's a huge wasted opportunity. You know, put these two into the pot with everyone else. And so Calpurnia becomes the driving force of the idea that she, in one exchange where she can't believe that Atticus has chewed out Jem for objecting to Mrs. DeBose, not just using the N-word in passing, but using it, I mean, with real hate, with blood dripping out.
Yeah, it's really animated. Yeah.
That it's Calpurnia who takes Atticus to task for that. When Atticus says, you know, I believe in respecting people, Calpurnia says, no matter who you're disrespecting by doing it. In other words, how do you think it makes me feel when you yell at Jem for defending me against Mrs. DeBose? So Calpurnia now, you know, is very much a force in the story. As for Tom Robinson, people remember that his undoing in the trial is when he's asked, why did you help out Mayella? Why did you do chores for her? The implication being that, you know, he had his eye on her, right? And his undoing in the trial is when he says, I felt sorry for her. And all the white people, you can't feel sorry for a white girl. That's impertinent. You don't know your place. And again, the book, in the movie, he does it by accident. He does it because he doesn't realize it's a big deal. And that's not really, Tom Robinson would absolutely know it's a big deal. So what happens in the play is, you know, we see a scene that's not in the book. We see the scene where Atticus first meets Tom Robinson, has his first meeting with him, and asks him the same question, why were you doing chores for Mayella? And Tom Robinson answers the question honestly, I felt sorry for her. And Atticus says, you can't say that in court. Whatever you do, don't say that in court. And we understand that for weeks of trial prep, Atticus tried to rattle Tom and to get him to say the wrong thing and to treat him the way Gilmer, the prosecutor, was going to treat him. Never shook Tom Robinson. Now when Tom Robinson says in court, I felt sorry for her, it is not an accident at all. It's an F you. He has been battered beyond human limits in this thing. And he's going to go down standing if he's going down. And now, just in dramatist terms, he has completed a hero's journey by doing that. So that was important to me.
Yeah, I mean, like your adaptation or your development of Atticus, who is already a full-fledged character in the novel, not as developed or not as developed and perhaps not as complex as a moment warranted. Mm-hmm. You've also put flesh, if you will, on the skeleton of Tom Robinson. Tom is absolutely central to the plot of the novel. Right? I mean, his, the accusation makes him central to the mechanization of the story.
And but yet, that's all he is in the novel, though. He is part of the machinery of it. Yeah. Now, listen, just by adding that scene and that part of the plot, I think it only begins to put flesh on him. I hope someone comes along in 20 years and writes To Kill a Mockingbird from the point of view of Tom Robinson. Let Atticus and Scout be supporting characters in that. Let Tom, he's got three kids. Let his kids be the Scout, Jem, and Dill of this version. And then 20 years after that, I hope somebody writes To Kill a Mockingbird from the point of view of Maella, who is abused by her father and kind of forced into telling this lie. And if nobody's going to write those plays, I hope people talk about that in classrooms. You know, in the last few years, To Kill a Mockingbird has been banned by a number of school districts in the country, both right and left, by the way. Banned by the right for making racism look bad, and banned by the left for the use of the N-word in the play. And it shouldn't be banned anywhere. It should be kids raising their hand in class and wanting to talk about this. Not just the story, but talk about the fact that when Harper Lee wrote the book, the only two black characters are really not involved in the tension of the story. One's a plot device and the other, again, she's just atmosphere. I want to see those discussions happen in classrooms and not school board meetings.
Aaron, you're speaking my language now. The classroom.
I know.
I loved how you threw the Childish Gambino reference in there, just ever so casually.
It's true. The horse does look like it.
Yeah, I mean, there are these really amazing moments in American theater. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of one, of a certain production of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, which has him looking into this abyss that's just right here on the other side of his backyard fence. And so, you know, I was mesmerized when you said about how you intentionally and deliberately move the audience's eyes over to a certain perspective, right? And to a certain kind of geography, some kind of landscape.
And I'll tell you something. We did the right now the play is on pause on Broadway because of COVID. It'll be reopening on Broadway. It's in the West End in London. It's on national tour, but it's we're on hiatus on Broadway. But before we shut down for COVID, we did something that's never been done before. We did a performance of the play at Madison Square Garden for 18,000 public school kids. And this was with the cooperation of New York State. You know, a lot of people helped with money for this, with the New York State Board of Education, rather. A new set was built during the day. The cast was rehearsing in this big warehouse in Queens. It had to be restaged so it could be in the round. And right up until the moment the play began that afternoon, at an 18,000 seat basketball arena, right up until the moment it began, I thought it was going to be a very well-intentioned train wreck. How could this possibly work in an 18,000 seat basketball arena in the round? And what are these kids going to do when they've been let out of school on a Wednesday afternoon? What are they going to do when the house lights go down? Because I know when I was that age, I'm not sure I'd be paying attention. Well, I'd be paying attention to a play. None of my friends would be, though. And it turned out to be the most profound experience I've ever had in a theater in my life. These kids were with it every step of the way. And we on Broadway, we play to a largely white, largely affluent audience. This was the first time we were doing the play for a diverse audience. First time we were doing it for people that young. And for most of these kids, this was their first experience with To Kill a Mockingbird. They hadn't read the book yet. They hadn't seen the movie. And it was just incredible. Especially the way they were experiencing Tom Robinson's journey through the play. Like I said, that it was for them, it was a hero's journey. And this guy was a martyr. And best of all, when it was done, it was nice to kind of walk out of the building with them, because none of them had any idea who I was. And so I was free to eavesdrop on conversations. They wanted more, more plays, more theater. For a lot of them, it was the first time they were seeing a play. And they wanted more of this. So I'm going to use this opportunity to kind of issue the ice bucket challenge to friends of mine who have plays on Broadway, Lin-Manuel, do Hamilton for students at Madison Square Garden. It's the reason you wanted to be a writer. Trust me, you're going to get more out of it than they will, and they're going to get a lot out of it.
Well, I mean, we're absolutely delighted that To Kill a Mockingbird will be coming to Chicago soon. And
yes,
if I could extend that challenge and swap it out with where the Chicago Bulls play, maybe you could have it at the United Center sometime in the not too distant future. And you've been talking a lot about, you know, not just the kind of opportunity to reach out to the youth, but it sounds to me like a real kind of ethical obligation that you feel to the youth. And so I wonder if you can say a little bit, because this is a play and the book that, and I know that you transformed it, but the frontispiece of it at least has a young child at the center. A young child's perspective, and it seems like your commitment to perspective is not simply rendering more complex Atticus, but in that layering of him, giving youth a different perspective of how to negotiate very difficult and very tenuous situations. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about how you saw Scout as a character, how you want to transform her in a way, and the friendship that she has with Dill and then her brother Jim, as something that perhaps not simply that we as adults, you know, from which we can learn as adults, but also other kids in the kind of contemporary youth population from which they might learn.
Sure. And I'll talk about Scout in just a second, but I think something you touched on at the beginning of your question is very important. We have to figure out a way to make great theater in America. And it's not just Broadway, it's Steppenwolf in Chicago. You know, it's the Guthrie in Minneapolis, it's the Globe in San Diego. We have got to figure out a way to make great theater available to young people who can't afford these ticket prices. Now on Broadway, anyone who went to a New York City public school could see the Wednesday matinee for $10. Anyone. So that's a start. But we've got to do it everywhere. It's got to be as accessible as a museum or a book. It really does. As far as Scout, the important thing for me right away was being okay with the idea that these weren't going to be child actors doing it. In other words, I could put dense, complicated language in their mouths. I could, you know, demand adult performances from them. And because it's a play and not a movie, and because we cast great actors in those roles, it's not at all jarring. And they are also, by the way, constantly, fluidly going back and forth between how old they are now when they're telling the audience the story, which is many years later, and how old they were then. So they're going back and forth between, you know, 9 and 39. And for Scout, what she ultimately comes to is the realization that her father, who she describes as the most honest and decent person in Macomb, covered up a murder. That was also something, by the way, that that caught my attention in revisiting the book. That no one, I mean, Harper Lee doesn't really comment on the fact that this whole thing ends with them covering up a murder. And again, to go back to the classroom, because I've heard some people talk about this, of where were those three guys, Atticus, the judge, and the sheriff, and their extrajudicial decision-making about Boo Radley's future. Was that white justice? In other words, why didn't the three of them huddle up and say, guys, doesn't matter how innocent Tom Robinson is, this is going to be a Macomb County jury, they are going to send him to the electric chair. What are we going to do about this? Instead, it was optimism. It was a belief that now, in a, it's a new scene, it's not in the book, in a scene between the judge and Atticus, the judge says, you know, he's been offered a deal, he's been offered 18 years, but I want him to have a jury trial. It's time, the judge says. In other words, I believe, you know, the South is ready to turn the corner. I believe Macomb is ready to turn the corner. We know these people. They're our friends and neighbors. They are not going to send an obviously innocent man to the electric chair. And tragically, they were wrong about that. So that's one of those things that I'd love to have talked about in the classroom. Hey, in this book that's supposed to be about justice, why are we okay with they made sure the white guy could get away with it, but not the black guy? I have an answer for that, but I would love for it to be a discussion in class.
You know, Aaron, first of all, you're always welcome to come to my classroom. So let my people, with your people, we'll invite you.
I promise I'll show up if you extend an invitation. Yeah,
no doubt. And, you know, part of what I'm hearing you say here, you know, this is a, you know, it's a novel that's almost 6 years, well over 6 years old now. And it's almost as if the original author could only come to what we would now call kind of racial reckoning by this kind of sleight of hand, because as you noted, like the extrajudicial latitude that these three men circulate in actually is a way to circumvent the deeper moral issue. Mm-hmm. That you know comes up, and it, you know, it's just by sheer coincidence, perhaps also not coincidence, that there's a kind of nice summary, a kind of tidying up that doesn't, you know, if you will, that delays the more difficult issue at point. Like, we're going to run this trial, right? The trial is going to be now because we're almost ready here, or we should be ready to run this trial.
But yes,
that doesn't quite happen in earlier versions of the story.
No, it didn't. And, you know, you use the words racial reckoning. You know, I had to have a reckoning of my own. There's a scene in the book, and it's also in the movie, that had always been my favorite scene in the whole thing. It had always been my father's favorite scene. And he and I would watch it together, and we'd tear up, we'd get a lump in our throat. We'd tear up and get a lump in our throat, even when we were just talking about it. And the scene is this. The trial is over. We're in the courtroom. The trial is over. Everyone's emptied out, except for the folks in what they called the colored section upstairs. They weren't allowed to sit downstairs. Atticus is packing his stuff in his briefcase. And he turns around, and it turns out that the folks upstairs in the colored section, they're all on their feet now, silently, paying respect to Atticus as he walks past. And the Reverend Sykes says to scouts up there, too, he says, you know, Miss Jean Louise, stand up, your daddy's passing. It was always a great emotional moment. It's a great movie moment. It is. And it was scored just right by Elmer Bernstein. But I have this habit of wanting to diagnose things. Like, why did I like that? Why did that work? Why did that not work? And here's the reason I liked it. It's because the people sitting upstairs, they were saying to Atticus, you're one of the good ones, and we're grateful to you. Here is our gratitude. We're grateful to you because you're one of the good ones. And, you know, white liberals want to be identified as being one of the good ones. The fact is, the folks upstairs should have been out in the streets chanting no justice, no peace. They should have been burning the courthouse down. They should have been burning Macomb down. But they were docile and respectful and grateful to the white guy. And once I realized that, I realized, you know, listen, if you're really going to do this, if you're really going to write a play that doesn't have bubble wrap around it, you have to address this. And so I did. I tried to in the play.
Yeah, that scene is it's a very complex one to say the least.
Listen, it's the scene that makes it. I've always, not until fairly recently, I've resisted complaints of it's a white savior play. With a very flip answer being, I'll take saviors in any color I can get them. You know, what's wrong with telling the story of a white guy who's heroic? Nothing, except if it's at the expense of the heroism of black folks. And the people up in the balcony, they were just helpless. They were dramatized as being helpless when they weren't and wouldn't have been and shouldn't have been.
Aaron, you know, as someone who plays with words a little bit, I really appreciate the way in which you just nuance that. They were dramatized to be complacent, right?
Yes.
When in fact, so we don't, you know, we aren't given enough view into their interiority. We aren't given enough perspective into their emotions, given the way that the characters were written in one iteration. So we can very, very, very easily, and I think also very profitably see how you were developing, in this case, Calpurnia and Tom, mm-hmm. to have a kind of dimensionality that was otherwise precluded from them in previous versions. And when you said here they were dramatized, they were presented to be docile. And I would just kind of add here that, you know, there is also a kind of politics of respectability that that helped govern how quiet protest was going to be enunciated versus what you were saying they should be in the streets burning down the courthouse. And those two things kind of go hand in hand, if you would, kind of politics of respectability. And this other that, you know, one of the key moments in the first film version, of course, and as you mentioned, you know, Scout, she's up with the folks, right? Mm-hmm. She's up in the colored section. She's in the section that has been reserved for African Americans because it's still Jim Crow America.
That's right.
But I wonder if they, and that scene is often read as a kind of future-oriented vision of what America could look like, right? Not now, but as Scal gets older and older and older, maybe down the road we will see a kind of integration. And maybe that integration won't be simply elevated, but it will be on the ground and in the pews itself.
That's right. And again, the fact that, I say we as if I'm able to speak for all Americans, of course I'm not, but other people I know, it feels like a lot of people, over the course of the last 4, 5, 6 years, we kind of felt like if we weren't in the end zone, we were close. We were on the 6 or 7 yard line or something. And so to discover that we weren't, that our friends and neighbors weren't who we thought it was, that America wasn't where we thought it was, that we were so easily led backward by a president was very disheartening, and I thought perfect for this play.
And we have just a couple minutes here. I mean, I want to thank you again for your time.
No, thank you.
No, it's been such a delight. But you know, since we've been talking about Scout and children and the youth, and something that one of the techniques that you were intentional about is that the characters in the play are older now. They're 39, they're 38. Mm-hmm. So we don't see their progress stage by stage or kind of error by error, but there is a distance from when they were children that allows them to be retrospective. And I want to ask you a few questions about just kind of looking back. And you said that this was a scene that you and your father had watched again and again. And you know, now as you know, one of the most important filmmakers and screenwriters and playwrights, and what's been very clearly evidenced to us today in this conversation, a really deep and kind of ethical commitment to the youth. I wonder if you would reapproach that moment you had, those moments you had with your father, outside of the luxury of nostalgia, and how would you reinterpret? And you know, I'm you know, this is actually partly about that moment, but can you take us back to when you first encountered American theater? Do you remember the first play that you saw?
I do, yeah. I'm not somebody who can remember a lot from when I was a little kid. But it was Man of La Mancha that my parents took me to when maybe I was 5 or 6 years old. I was lucky for it, but they had a habit of taking me to see shows that I was much too young to understand what was going on there. But we were sitting up in the balcony, and those are the tickets my parents could afford. And my first memory simply is that the show hadn't started yet. The house lights were still up, but I saw the top of a bassoon kind of peeking out of the orchestra pit. And I don't know why I remember that so clearly. It was my realization that this wasn't television, that this was going to be live. And it really excited me. And then for those who don't know how Man of La Mancha begins, the whole thing is being acted out in a prison dungeon where the Spanish Inquisition is interrogating people. This staircase would creak down on a chain and somebody would be brought up and you just knew they were never coming back. They were going to get killed up there. And so the lights came down, hear this magnificent overture, the curtain went up, the scariest staircase in all of theater creaked down, and two things happened. One was I wanted to live in this theater. It was a cathedral. I didn't want to go back out to the sidewalk. I wanted to live here. And the other was Don Quixote would be my hero. And it's back to my father. It's who my father most resembles to me. And there was no turning back. There was never a moment I didn't want to be around that, near that. I never imagined being able to create it, like I was going to write a play.
Yeah, you have. And so like, you know, we have time for basically this last question. In talking about your previous experience with theater and with drama, you know, it's been characterized as this is a kind of, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird was a kind of return to theater for you, return to drama. But it seems from your last answer that it's never left you. It's been kind of living in inside of you. And it's like,
It never has. I am a playwright who finds ways to fake his way through movies and television. It's, you know, the theater is what I studied formally in college. I always loved movies and television shows as much as anybody else. I watched them for some reason. I never connected to it as something I could write too, in addition to plays. So it's an old story. My first play was A Few Good Men. It opened when I was very young. I was brought out to L.A. to do the movie adaptation, and the plan was to go right back to New York and write my second play. I wrote my second play 17 years later. I've been trying not to take too much time between plays since. I have something new opening in the fall on Broadway.
Yeah, please tell us about it.
Continuing the tradition I started with To Kill a Mockingbird of writing things that have already been written, I have written a new book for Camelot. This is the same score, but it's a new, brand new telling of the legend of King Arthur. And Bart Scher, the director of To Kill a Mockingbird, is directing it, and it'll be at Lincoln Center starting previews in November.
On that note, you heard it here that Aaron Sorkin thinks about himself initially as a playwright, and it's never left him. We'll look forward to seeing To Kill a Mockingbird throughout Chicago, and of course, for the new work when it hits the stage in the not too distant future. Before I sign off, I really want to thank Aaron again on behalf of the American Writers Museum for joining us this afternoon as part of the programming for the Writers Festival this weekend in May of 2022 in Chicago.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the chat.
Such a pleasure. All right, cheers. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, best-selling author Sudhir Venkatesh discusses his new book, The Tomorrow Game, Rival Teenagers, Their Race for a Gun, and a Community United to Save Them. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.